for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 17th of October. I'm Alberto Montilla.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:10 in time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion for this week's top science findings.
We also have news correspondent Morgan Yee in studio to interview Samantha Truong, a UBC student participating in the annual Raise the Rates Challenge.
Later in the program, news correspondent Emily Blake speaks with the creators of the real-time nightlife app, Nightbound, as well as news correspondent Konstantin Pradanovich's piece on the university's proposed tuition and residence fee increases.
We also have an interview with Pivot Legal Society's Kevin Hollett, who spoke with news correspondent Morgan Yee earlier today about Wednesday's eviction of the residents of the Oppenheimer Park homeless camp. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC receives $11.6 million grant for new Canada research chairs. Yesterday, the Canada Research Chair Program awarded UBC $11.6 million, enough to fund 16 chair positions. Nationally, 137 chairholder positions were created across 37 post-secondary institutions, receiving $118 million of federal funds. Minister of State Science and Technology Ed Holder reiterated that, quote, "Our government is committed to science, technology, and innovation to improve our quality of life and create new jobs and opportunities for Canadians." With three renewals and 13 new appointments, UBC now has the second highest number of Canada research chairs in the country at 186. Vice President Research and International John Hepburn of UBC issued a statement saying, quote, "Our professors are making important discoveries that are invaluable to academia and to the world at large, so we're very grateful for the program's support."
The Dalai Lama will visit UBC this Wednesday. His Holiness will present a talk on empowerment, teaching, and compassion to support the Tibetan resettlement project here in British Columbia. The full-day event will take place this upcoming Wednesday, October 23rd. All audiences invited to attend in the Thunderbird Arena here on the Point Grey campus.
In local news, a bulk fuel tanker has lost power and is drifting towards Haida Gwaii. According to the Globe and Mail, the Canadian Coast Guard received a call at 11 p.m. last night about the ship, which is carrying 450 tons of fuel. The tanker lost power, and the crew can no longer change its course. The tanker drifted within 14 kilometers of the coast and shows no signs of stopping. The dangerous cargo is cause for concern, as the ship is reportedly carrying 400 tons of bunker fuel and 50 tons of diesel fuel. The Council of the Haida Nation has declared a state of emergency, releasing a statement on their Facebook page, quote, "The Coast Guard is preparing for the worst, with the ship hitting ground in 3 to 4 hours. The Coast Guard has dispatched two tugboats from Alaska and Prince Rupert, but it is estimated that they will not arrive before the ship reaches Haida Gwaii." This is, of course, a breaking story, and we will be updating you as it develops.
In national news, the first Canadian casualty of the enterovirus D68 has been reported in Vancouver. The BC Centre for Disease Control confirmed this morning that a man from the Lower Mainland passed away after contracting enterovirus D68. The man in his 20s was admitted to the hospital earlier this week and did not show signs of paralysis or the neurological symptoms which can occur in some cases. However, Dr. Dantu Skoronsky with the BCCDC said that it's not currently known to what extent D68 may have caused or contributed to his death. The BCCDC has confirmed that 36 cases of enterovirus D68 have been diagnosed in the province, a doubling in last week's number. The cases appeared in patients ranging from less than 1 year old to more than 80 years old, but Dr. Skowronski said that, consistent with elsewhere, 65% of the cases are children under 10 years of age, and only about 15 to 20% of adults of 20 or more years of age, end quote. The first Canadian death in addition to 7 U.S. fatalities. Canadian's chief public health officer, Dr. Gregory Taylor, called for a cautious optimism, saying that while there's no vaccine for enterovirus, most people who are infected will have mild symptoms, end quote. Our surveillance shows that the number of cases are actually going down, adding that, quote, I think Canadians need reassurance.
Those are your campus, local, and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Boy Tree Youth Clinic.
If you're going to be a zombie, be one with a brain. With Halloween just around the corner, the provincial government is doing something very scary by closing the only dedicated public youth medical clinic in Vancouver. The Pine Free Youth Clinic has been providing safe, confidential, effective, community-based health services for young adults and teens on the west side for over 40 years. The provincial government is closing this important clinic on October 31st. That's why David Eby, the MLA for Vancouver Point Grey, is standing up for the clinic with one last rally, a zombie walk to bring the Pine Free Clinic back from the dead. Come show your support for community-based dedicated healthcare for young people at the zombie walk to save the Pine Free Youth Clinic. It all takes place Sunday, October 26th from 1 to 2 p.m. in front of the clinic at West 4th and Maple Street in Kitsilano. Bring your best zombie outfit. Together we can bring the Pine Free Youth Clinic back to life. Non-zombies also welcome.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Good afternoon. The lead story is about the potent heroin that is causing overdoses in Vancouver. Last Tuesday's National Post reports that health officials say that a potent spiked brand of heroin has caused 21 overdoses and one death in Vancouver. These overdoses occurred at a place called Insight, which is a safe injection site, which is supervised drug injection. Gavin Wilson, spokesman of Vancouver Coastal Health, describes these numbers as very high. Canada's Centre for Substance Abuse said that during the first 4 months of this year, there have been 13 overdose deaths from fentanyl, which is the substance that the people are overdosing on. It is not heroin. Gavin Wilson and the Canadian Centre for Substance Abuse describes these numbers as very high. Vancouver police have issued an alert about the heroin and the fentanyl, but people on the east side seem to like it because it causes a longer high. In other health news, a Canadian-made Ebola vaccine has started clinical trials in the U.S. last Monday. The Canadian federal government has said, and quote, the drug could be shipped to West Africa within months if it is successful. Newlinks Genetics from New Jersey holds rights for testing. 20 vials of the drug have been sent to a Maryland research center for testing. They will be tested on 40 very, very brave, healthy volunteers. The vaccine is called VSB-EBOV, and it has been tested on primates successfully. The tests have showed that if the primates are injected before Ebola contracted, it prevents the infection from starting. It has also shown that survival chances are higher after the Ebola is contracted. I will keep you posted in our next edition on this story. In other news, killer whales learn how to speak dolphin. This was in last week's Live Science, October 10. Killer whales are known for their haunting sounds and complex whistles, clicks, and pauses, but they can also learn dolphin speak. Most animals communicate with innate sounds. For example, dogs bark, turkeys gobble, 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 and owls hoot. But humans, which are some of the species, can learn new sounds and how to use them correctly in social situations. This is called vocal learning, and it is found in some bats, some birds, and in cetaceans, which are whales, dolphins, or porpoises. Scientists have identified neural pathways that play a role in learning, and they have seen that killer whales possess these neural pathways. When killer whales socialize with dolphins, it has been shown by Anne Bowles, a research assistant at Hubs SeaWorld Resort in Carlsbad, California, that the killer whales, when they socialize with the dolphins, they change the type of sound they made to resemble that of the dolphins. The killer whales' original vocalization include clicks, whistles, and pulsed calls. But now, when the killer whales were mixed in with dolphin populations and bulls, the research scientists collected sound recordings from three killer whales housed with the dolphins. This study was done over several years. Dr. Bowles compared her data with sounds from seven killer whales that were not housed together with dolphins. The three killer whales that were housed with the bullnose dolphins learned how to speak dolphin. They pulsed less, but they clicked and whistled more. So the killer whales have a high level of neuroplasticity, so their brain circuits can change and incorporate new information. In other news relevant to British Columbia, in the journal Innovation, a research magazine, Michelle Despot, a professional engineer, debunks the myths about solar power. Ms. Despot says, and quote, "The solar industry is experiencing exponential growth. From 2005, it increased 27-fold. So Dr. Deboth looks at California, which is aiming at 5% solar power within 2 years, and Germany, which this year is using 50 or more than 50% of its energy from solar power. And Germany has as much sun as Haida Gwaii. So the conclusion is we can have a solar industry in BC. The solar maps from southern Alberta and southwest British Columbia show these are the best places for solar power in Canada because they have over 2,000 hours per year of sun. You can see the data at www.ecosmartsun.com/Canada-solar-maps. This is Marco. You're up to date with your science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take another PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout. Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thanks for being with us.
Up next, we have news correspondent Morgan Yee live in studio to speak with Samantha Truong, a UBC student participating in the annual Raise the Rates Challenge.
Hey, Sam. Welcome to News 101.
Hey, Morgan.
So can you tell us a little bit about what the Raise the Rates Challenge is?
Raise the Rates is a challenge to raise awareness on welfare rates in and to show that it's not an adequate amount of money that people are living on currently. An average person, that's a single able-bodied person, expected to have $610 a month for all their spending, including rent and food. So this is not an adequate amount. The raise the rates are getting participants to spend $21 a week on food to show that it's not a good amount and that they need to raise these rates.
And when did you start the challenge?
I started just yesterday, which is Thursday, as that's World Food Day.
Okay, and how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling all right. I had a tough morning, I'd say. I start off with half a cup of oatmeal, some tea, and some vegetable sticks at lunch. I ended up eating my lunch a lot earlier than I was supposed to. I ate it around 10 a.m. when it was scheduled for 1. Then I ate my dinner at 3. Don't know what I'm going to do for dinner, but yeah, it's been challenging so far. It's been kind of eye-opening to see that this is a reality for many people, and I've been really able to see the privilege that I have being able to just live this life for a week, and I acknowledge that it's a struggle for people day-to-day for nearly how long they're on welfare. It could be years.
And have you found that it's affected the way you've dealt with your daily life so far?
Yeah, I have. So I've been keeping a blog. It's called Samantha Does Welfare Food Challenge. And I've been posting what I've been eating there. And I've noticed that I have been getting angry, short in patience. And like last night, I had an assignment to do. It was past midnight, but I was getting hungry. So I was wondering if I should continue on with my assignment or go to sleep, because if I was hungry, I wouldn't be able to sleep. And this was just a conflict I thought of, and I ended up finishing my assignment, but it was tough. I stayed up later than I would have because I was hungry and I couldn't sleep. So that's one way it has affected me so far.
Now, is there any other way for students who are listening or community members that if they want to get involved, that they can?
Yes. There are a couple of ways, three ways. First one, they can take the challenge on as well. I know it started on Thursday, but everyone can do it any time of the week just to experience how that $21 a week really feels like. Secondly, they can sign a petition online to raise the rates. They're looking for 5,000 signatures. Currently, they're halfway there. It's only been going on for a week, so that's great, great numbers. You can find that by just Googling Raise the Rates or Welfare Food Challenge, and it's one of the first links you can get. And secondly, they can sign, they can write a letter to our premier to kind of show that we want to raise the rates. So those are three main ways we can get involved. Contact media. I'm here with the awesome CITR. They're able to spread my word. I think it's important to get the message out so people can just see that this is a reality and that welfare and poverty affects everyone and not just those on welfare.
And just out of curiosity, what did you end up buying with your $21?
That's a great question. I just wanted to really note that it takes a lot of time to live in poverty. I spent, what I mean by that, I spent 4 hours just planning what I was going to buy for those with $21, comparing grocery stores and finding where the cheapest almond milk is and whatnot. And I bought potatoes, because potatoes are cheap and they're starchy and will fill me. 10 pounds of potatoes I will be eating this week alone. Good times. It's that was $5 for a big bag of that. That was already, what is that? A third of my budget? Sorry, terrible math. But yeah, that's a third. And I got eggs, soy milk, just a lot of veggies, cucumber, celery, and broccoli, and oatmeal. That's all. I was thinking, I thought the list would be longer, but it just kind of stopped there. Oh, no. How could I forget this? I found instant noodles on sale. Okay, listen. 29 cents for no-name shrimp-flavored instant noodles. Like, my body hates me by the end of this challenge, but I realized by when I was preparing my list that you really need to compromise. Well, I had to compromise with my resources available for me. I live in Totem Park. I'm a residence advisor there, so we don't have a kitchen, which makes it more challenging. But I realized that I'm going to have to compromise a healthy, nutritious diet for not getting hungry. And I actually found this stat, which I really wanted to share, which was that the Dietetics of Canada says that for a basic healthy diet with no luxuries like coffee, etc. A woman must spend around $200 a month, and an adult man must spend like $250. I don't know, like, if they that really matters between woman or man, but that's what the Dietitians of Canada says. So that's just fascinating because I have $21 a week. That's like times four. It's not even $100. Not even half of what the dietitians are recommending.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your story.
Yeah,
and good luck with that. And we'll post your a link to your blog on our Facebook page.
Oh, that's so kind. Cool. It's Samantha Does Welfare Food Challenge.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
We'll be right back after a short PSA break.
Face the TV screen. Time for the hate half hour.
Hate, 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 hate.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Don't just hate radio, just love your radio.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have an interview conducted by news correspondent Emily Blake. She spoke with the creators of real-time nightlife app, Nightbound. Vancouver resident Matt Gu is the visionary behind the app, with UBC computer science graduate students Rahul Jirasal and Deepak Azad. The app currently has just under 9,000 users, with 200 to 300 users that are active daily. They discuss the development process, business models, the components of a successful business team, and offer advice to young entrepreneurs.
So how long did it take to develop this app?
I would say about two and a half months to build the first version, and then we kept iterating and building more on top of this.
Okay. What separate roles do you all play in the development and maintenance of the app?
So Matt's basically the business guy. He's the one who comes up with requirements. He also designs the visual layout of the app. Rahul and I do the coding. He does the iOS app, I do the Android app, and we split the work on the back end.
So what was the development process like?
If you look at the development processes that they use in the industry, they're pretty heavyweight. They have a lot of logging of everything. They have all kinds of documentation. Our process is very lightweight. Process usually adds an overhead, and the team is small enough that we don't need any formal process to define anything.
It's a lot based on what we learn and about the industry, about our users, and we build based on that. As we learn new things, we try to incorporate them.
How many people are involved in collecting data for the app?
Right now we have a variety of different sources. The first one we get is people actually at the venue updating. That's what we started with. But as we realized early on that that wasn't enough to be at the capacity where we have really accurate information. So since then we've partnered with the venues. So there are a couple of venues where the managers have assigned particular roles and designated that to people in the venue. We get some data from the ID scanners. And then also now we've just incorporated what I call Nightbound ambassadors. They essentially ride around the city and check out every venue and make sure that the data is actually accurate, or if there's nothing there, they also update the venue as well.
And was it difficult getting venues to participate?
I think so. I mean, it's a very slow and backwards industry, so for us to go in with not a lot of connections, I would say, it was providing them, selling them a value that we didn't yet have. In the beginning, we realized that we really needed to focus on the user end, and once we have a lot of people checking out the app, that's very good leverage for us to go into a venue and use that as something to negotiate with.
What was the process like advertising and trying to get subscribers?
When we launched, we didn't really have a lot of, I think, hype around the app. A lot of our users came from friends and family and just social media in general. And then we also added that with a lot of press that we were able to get throughout the months after release. So in the beginning, I think did a really good job onboarding new users. But the problem is that press comes in bursts. So what we have to figure out is other consistent methods for us to get users.
What other challenges have you faced while making this app?
I mean, we're all first-time entrepreneurs. You know, I've had some experience with my previous startup, but I think we never took it this far. Sometimes you just don't know where to go and you don't know what to work on. And there's so many different aspects about this particular startup that sometimes you go crazy thinking that there's so many different things you can accomplish. But in reality, what I realize now is you really have to focus And just because you can build it doesn't mean that it should be built. And prioritizing on different things is really important. So having a lot of discipline and building upon that is extremely important.
I think writing code is not a big challenge. That's, I think, the easiest part of building a startup or building a product. The hardest part would be to know what to write code for. That's what Matt does. He asks us questions. We ask him questions.
Are there any other apps or business models that you've looked at for inspiration?
I think we definitely look at other nightlife startups in the country and US. There hasn't really been one that's very, very popular yet. That could be a good or a bad thing. There's a reason why a lot of them fail. And there's a lot of real-time so-called apps in the past that we've discovered, and they ran for a few months before they died. Yes, there's not a lot of competitors in the market, but at the same time, the big thing for us to figure out is why they perished. In terms of business models, look at a lot of the big ones. I mean, we're in what's called a two-sided marketplace, where we have two parties to deal with, one being the clubs and then one being the users, who have completely different needs and pain points, completely different feature needs. So for us, it's very difficult to kind of be in the middle and figure out what to build. It's really about leverage. For example, if we have some venues and we want to get more users, we can't get more users unless we have more venues. The venue side, they're not going to care unless you have a lot more users using your app. So it's a lot of going back and forth and being able to balance the two. That's really challenging. So we look at Uber, Airbnb as kind of the role models for us as we develop.
What advice do you have for young entrepreneurs, especially those looking to develop apps?
The biggest advice is just start building something. If you have an idea, just find a team, form a team, and get going. There'll be setbacks and you'll learn stuff along the way, and that's the fun part. And having a good team is really important. The three of us work really well. It's really easy to work for us in a group, so that's really helps.
I say get uncomfortable. That's when you really learn, when you put yourself in a situation where you're forced to be someone else. So if you're a developer, go out and talk to business owners and figure out if they actually want the product you're building. If you are a business guy, go out and learn some code so you are proficient and you don't sound like an idiot when you're talking to developers.
I would like to add to what Deepak says, start building. As you're building, also start validating what you're building. Sometimes validation comes even before building. If you have an idea, see if you can make sure that people want this even before you build the product out. First, start with a really small thing that is the minimum viable product that has least amount of efforts from your end, and see if people like it, and then start improving on that. For each small improvement, validate your smaller ideas and see if users like it. Move fast and break things and fix them.
What do you think makes a good business team?
Having trust is really important. You're a small team. If that's not there, the team will sort of fall apart.
Yeah, and it's really nice that we got that trust built up in the first few months, and now we're really comfortable working with each other. Competency is important too. You don't want someone who is not competent. But sometimes having the will to do something is more important than being competent, because you can learn something that you're not good at.
Okay.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And I'm Alberto Montoya.
You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thanks for being with us. Up next on the program, we have an in-depth interview, or rather a look at university's proposed tuition and residence increases with news correspondent Konstantin Pradanovich.
I came to UBC because I was offered a scholarship, and my choice would have been very different if the proposals that were made today were to have been implemented 4 years ago. About housing fees were brought to student leaders across campus, framed as a decision that had already been made with little or no consultation with students up to that point. My question is, how is it fiscally responsible to demand 20% increase from your students without providing information of where this money is going to be going?
How
How long have they been sitting on this? How long have they had to think about this, to gather the information, to gather the facts, to talk about it, to discuss it, to come back and decide on the best move forward? 30 days? 30 days plus 2 weeks? I don't know about you, but I very much doubt it. And they know that in these 30 days, we have midterms and papers, we have scholarship requirements, we have jobs, we have families to take care of, we have lives. They know that any less time than they had, any less resources than they had, any less information than they had is inadequate. They trust that we will trust them to make the best decision for us. We shouldn't.
Those are the voices of student leaders speaking up over a new proposal to increase residence fees and international student tuition at UBC. Late last week, UBC administrators approached the student union to unveil a plan to increase international tuition 10% and to hike residence costs 20% respectively. The new cost for on-campus residents would average out to between $725 and $778 a month, which the administration has insisted is under the market value of an off-campus residence on a per-student basis. For incoming international students, this would be a double whammy. International tuition already averages out to roughly $26,000 a year, depending on the program. The new proposal is based on a need to invest in, quote, academic excellence. It will now be a subject to a 30-day consultation process in which the administration will hear from student leadership and the general student population alike. Student groups have also been vocal in their criticism of the proposal. Over the last week, there has been an outpouring of student response regarding the issue. The proposal has been criticized for not clearly outlining where the money from the increases will be going. Many have also pointed to the fact that the administration has used similar cost hikes at other Canadian universities as justification for the increases, without much substance as to why the increases are necessary. I sat down with VP Academic of the Student Union, Anne Kessler, to hear about her thoughts on the proposal. As VP Academic, Kessler is the liaison between students and the administration on issues of education, housing, and well-being. So I guess we can kind of dive right into the thick of it. In light of Tuesday's motion to oppose the proposed increase to international student tuition and residence fees, how does the AMS exactly plan to fight the administration on this issue?
Okay. Well, I think our first strategy is to really make sure that students know what's going on. I think we have as much power as we are given by students, and I think the more that students know about it and the more that students go to the town halls, make sure that the administration really officially, through their own means, knows that students are opposed to this, I think that's really important. So making sure that they know that the town halls are happening, that they know that they have the opportunity to have their voice heard, I think that's super important. We are also meeting very frequently with the administration. We had a meeting yesterday, we had a meeting last week, and we've really been asking them to give us any information they have. So far, they've given us really nothing. They haven't provided us with kind of detailed breakdowns of how they are proposing to be spending this money, which to us, I think is a really important detail to tell students how the money is going to be spent. And so they've told us that at a meeting next week, they're going to have this all laid out for us. They're going to provide it to us beforehand so we can really take a look and have a discussion. And so I think a lot of what we do is going to depend on what they come back to us with.
Right. Not to be overly anticipatory, but what happens if students aren't listened to during the consultations?
I mean, I think it depends at what point they're not listened to. I think it's probably important to clarify at the moment the difference between the international tuition issue versus the housing issue. So for the international tuition issue, there is an official consultation process that the university has to go through. That's finished on November 21st, and they plan to bring that to the Board of Governors at the Board of Governors meeting in late November, and then the committee in late November, then early December for full board. And so I think really if students aren't listened to, I think we're going to be making sure that our student board of governors really know what students have been voiced. And what's important about the official consultation versus maybe student action on campus is that all the official consultation will be provided to the Board of Governors in their packages to be seen. So each governor does have an opportunity to see what students have said. If they aren't listened to, I think then we need to evaluate what we can be doing, who we can be talking to. Ultimately, tuition, I believe, does have to be approved by the province, so that might be something that we could talk about.
At the moment, what's the likelihood of these proposals going through? Could you speak a little to that, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell. I think I also wouldn't want to sort of... I think there are some people who are going to be pessimistic and say there's no chance of this happening. We should just negotiate with the university about what the money is going to be spent on. But I think that's being really pessimistic, and I think that we need to be optimistic in this and really say this is our opinion and trust that the university is actually going to be intelligent and listen to its students.
Right. You have been very vocal in your opposition to the increases, and I understand that's obviously a part of your mandate as VP Academic to do so, but this fight seems to mean more than that to you. Why does the issue strike you so personally?
Let me go back to actually how I first got involved in the AMS.
Right.
So I got involved at the end of my first year, and a good friend of mine who was at the time involved in the Social Justice Center, but I didn't know him from the Social Justice Center. I knew him from something totally different, church actually. and he was saying, you know, that we were talking in January about the AMS elections that were happening, and I was a first year and I didn't really know anything, and so he was kind of telling me what was going on because he was in like fifth year, and I was really interested, and then he said, you know what, you should run to be an AMS rep. And so I knew nothing about campus politics at all. He totally ran my campaign for me, and I think I had three campaign points. I don't think I remember what the third one was. but my first one was around accessibility, and the second one was about equity, because fairly recently at the time that the Spark report had come out around equity within the AMS, and so that was something that I was really interested in working on. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't really work on those things for a long time. As an AMS counselor, you don't always have the power to really make that change. But I think it's been funny for me reflecting on that recently because it's really what I'm working on now. And so where does it personally come from? I think it's like a values thing. You know, I identify as somebody who's a feminist and who really tries to work for social justice, and it's not always easy, and it's not always fun, but it's been an opportunity in the past
right.
week.
This has been a long time.
Week and a half to say, you know what, this is a chance to really work on these
Absolutely.
Things because it matters.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, apparently. What sort of a distribution of financial resources would you like to see available for international on-campus students, respectively?
What do you mean?
As it stands, there's an affordability issue, and it's been tight for both the university and for students. And these proposed changes obviously come from a place of the administration that they see it necessary, or at least that they're proposing it as if it was necessary. Do you think that there's any way to go about this without the proposing a tuition increase, or especially for international students, or residence increase?
Yeah, so I mean, I think our VP External would talk a lot about the importance of government. I think this is only happening in a context where the government allows the institution to increase housing and to increase international tuition on this scale. They have a cap on domestic tuition, and to be honest, that's really the only reason the university is not looking at that. In fact, we do actually know that they are looking at that. They are in talks with the provincial government allowing them for law tuition increased because law is in a huge deficit right now.
Right.
So really, the only reason they're not talking too much about domestic is because they can't. And so the government is really important, and I think as you say, you know, the university is in a tight situation, and I think if we forget that the university is in a really tight situation, we're not going to have an intelligent conversation
right,
with the university where they're actually going to listen to us. But I think it's, at least what I've heard in the discourse between the sort of student leaders who have been sitting at these meetings and the administration so far, has been a conversation of want, not necessarily of need. Mm-hmm. When asked things like, will not increasing tuition lower our standard of education, it's not a no.
Right.
It's a roundabout answer that doesn't really answer the question. And so they're talking about
does Pivot Legal Society take on at this point?
At this point, our role is done. The capacity that we worked on Oppenheimer Park was to serve as legal representatives for some of the homeless campers there. So these were the people who were in really desperate situations, who had nowhere else to go. And what we tried to tell the court was that they needed more time to be connected with meaningful housing options. We saw over the last couple of days that there were challenges making sure that everyone who wanted to take up the option did have the option to actually connect with shelter and housing. But there needed to be more time for people.
Now, it's my understanding that there was a very similar case in Victoria a while back. I can't remember the exact dates. But the Supreme Court of BC denied an injunction to have the camp dismantled.
Mm-hmm.
What was different in this case?
The difference in this case was that the justice received evidence from the city that they were providing shelter for everyone that needed it at the camp. So in Victoria, the decision in RV Adams was that the injunction would not be granted if people didn't have any other options. So what Vancouver endeavored to do, the city of Vancouver endeavored to do, was to make sure that there were at least shelter beds for everyone that needed one in the camp.
So what other measures could the city have taken in this situation, do you think?
Honestly, it's I think it's pretty deplorable that a city, and it's not just Vancouver, but cities across Canada are being left to deal with a housing crisis. They've been failed by senior levels of government. They've been failed by the federal government, who has neglected to have a national housing strategy. We're one of the few developed countries that does not. We should be incredibly embarrassed by that. Our provincial governments have failed in providing financial support for cities. So cities are left to deal with this crisis on their own. A lot of them use bylaws to police homelessness. Vancouver is actually one of the good examples, because we have situations across BC that are far less humane. In Abbotsford last year, there was stories of people being evicted from their tents a few days before Christmas, of city officials spreading chicken manure on campgrounds to get people to leave. So when we see the federal government and the provincial government fail the municipalities in supporting them, this is the result.
And now, with Pivot, do you guys advocate federally as well as locally and provincially?
For sure. Our model is to use the law to try to change human rights. So we're right now challenging bylaws in Abbotsford to allow people to be able to sleep outside when they have no other options. The right to security of person is what we're arguing.
And sorry, just to cut in, what's the basis of a bylaw that's preventing people from sleeping outside in public?
What's the basis? So what's their
the
motivation behind a lot of the bylaws that end up ultimately policing and displacing people living in poverty is that it's a huge societal problem, and the easiest way to deal with it is to make it less visible.
Okay. I think that's everything that I had for you, Kevin.
You want me to say thanks? That's our program for today, October 17th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Alberto Montilla.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. Today's show was produced by